Today is November the 4th, 2020. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Twitter, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Better internet in rural areas would attract new work-from-home people. The COVID-19 pandemic has changed offices and classrooms across America, with millions now working from home and going to school remotely. With this new freedom to work from anywhere, Americans are interested in moving away from cities. And if so, what are they looking for in rural areas in regard to internet service? The survey by PoFish was to find out if internet connection speeds are currently fast enough to support work from home and online schooling, particularly in rural areas. 54% of the respondents said they were working from home in the 2020 pandemic. 67% said that internet availability in an area would affect their decision to move somewhere more rural. 36% said bad or limited internet access is preventing them from moving to more rural areas. If given the chance to work from home permanently, 2 out of 3 respondents would move away from the city for more living space. 29% said their internet connection at home is reimbursed by their employer. It's no surprise that the switch to work from home has increased the desire for a bigger living space. Quarantining inside an apartment can be rough. 2 out of 3 people say they moved away from the city if they could work from home permanently, which would be the new norm for tens of thousands of workers even after the pandemic. But for most of these people who could help revitalize rural areas, a good internet connection is essential. In the survey, 67% of the people say they'll take internet availability into consideration before moving to a rural area. This highlights the importance of expanding internet access into underserved areas, which has been shown to have a positive socioeconomic impact. People are craving the extra space and affordable housing that they can get in rural areas, but they need to know how to get good internet in the country. There are plenty of people in rural and urban areas who are struggling to stay connected during the pandemic. 29% of respondents said their current internet connection has difficulty supporting work from home or online learning, and over 30% are using a hotspot or mobile tethering at home to get internet access, which is often slower and more expensive than internet plans available in urban areas. As companies establish long-term work-from-home policies, employers are starting to pick up the tab for basic home office expenses. The survey found that 28% of work-from-home employees say the internet is reimbursed by the employer. They also found that the top complaint about working from home is a slow or unreliable internet connection. So a good way for employers to alleviate this problem is to pick up the tab for internet service. In case you're wondering how employers can afford to pay for employees' home internet, the answer is that companies save big money when employees work from home. According to Global Workplace Analytics, employers save $11,000 a year for each employee who works from home at least half-time. Global Workplace Analytics calculated the savings based on numerous factors, including decreased real estate costs and absenteeism. For the first time in decades, millions of Americans are reconsidering the benefits of urban living and setting their sights on suburbs, small towns, and rural areas. The flight from urban center is seen acutely in places like New York City, where 5,000 households a week have left the city. Although these moving trends may be temporary, some aspects of this urban exodus may be longer lasting. When the survey asked participants about what they do if work from home became a permanent option at their company, 66% of the people said they would consider moving away from the city. These changing trends could have a significant impact on suburban and rural America for years to come. The survey not only reveals the prevalence of work from home during the COVID-19 pandemic, but it also suggests how work from home will impact rural America now and into the future. The findings suggest that rural areas with good internet access will continue to attract new residents, while places without decent internet options will be seen as less desirable, falling further off the map. As the urban exodus continues and work-from-home opportunities persist, broadband internet access will continue to be a critical factor in helping rural America adapt and prosper during the pandemic and beyond. SatelliteInternet.com surveyed hundreds of Americans to learn more about how they're working and studying from home in 2020. They asked the respondents where they live, whether they consider moving away from the city for more space, and whether internet availability would affect moving to a rural area. Participants were ages 16 to 54 plus and from all 50 states, and the survey was distributed online via PoFish. Reports from the cable TV operators. With cord cutting of cable subscription TV and the increase in broadband internet traffic, how are the major cable providers doing? Spectrum TV subscribers were up, while Verizon and Comcast base of cable subscribers are down. All three reported gains in their broadband business. Charter and Verizon both reported revenue increases, while revenue was down for Comcast. In the cable TV subscription area, there may be cord cutting, but it has not affected Spectrum. Cable operator Charter Communications reported that it grew its pay TV subscribers in the third quarter as broadband user growth amid the coronavirus pandemic once again drove its results. The cable giant Charter, which operates Spectrum cable TV service, reported an estimated $218 million in credits for video customers. They mentioned planned rebates for customers due to sports programming affected by the coronavirus pandemic. During the pandemic, there has been very little sports programming. They mentioned that $218 million of estimated credits to be provided to Charter's video customers upon finalization of expected rebates from sports programming networks, which results from fewer games broadcast during COVID-19. Management has in the past said it would like to provide such rebates to subscribers. Full details on the rebates weren't immediately available. Charter added 2 million customer relationships in the past year. Charter also disclosed last week in a regulatory filing that they added 53,000 residential pay TV subscribers in the third quarter, compared with a loss of 77,000 in the year-ago period. Including small and medium-sized business clients, it added 67,000 customers, a swing from a year-ago loss of 75,000. It was a second quarter of gains in a row. As of the end of September, Charter had 15.7 million residential and more than 16.2 million total video customers. Verizon loses 67,000 pay TV subscribers in the third quarter. Telecom giant Verizon last week reported that it lost 67,000 net pay TV subscribers for its Fios consumer video service in the third quarter, compared with a loss of 63,000 in the year-ago period and a loss of 52,000 in the second quarter. Fios, which competes with cable and satellite TV services, ended September with 4.2 million total video subscribers in its customers unit, whose subscriber decline in the latest period compared with a 1,000 subscriber gain in Verizon's business services unit. The subscribers' losses were reflecting the ongoing shift from traditional linear video to over-the-top offerings. Comcast cable business, on the other hand, recorded revenue growth despite losing a total of 273,000 video subscribers in the third quarter. The cable giant lost 253,000 residential video subscribers, and another 20,000 business video customers. The losses were well ahead of the 238,000 total video subscribers lost in the same quarter of 2019, but meaningfully down from the 477,000 lost in the previous quarter. Comcast ended the third quarter with 19.22 million residential and 874,000 business video subscribers, giving it approximately 20.1 million total. In the internet broadband business, Charter's broadband business led the growth charge in the latest quarter as the firm recorded 494,000 residential internet subscriber net additions, up from 351,000 in the year-ago period, including small and medium-sized business clients, a total gain of 537,000 compared with 380,000 in the year-ago period. Over the last 12 months, total internet customers grew by 2.3 million, or 8.8%, to 28.6 million. Verizon broadband service added 36,000 subscribers in the third quarter, including 30,000 in its customer and 6,000 in its business service unit, compared with 54,000 in the year-ago period. Comcast, in the third quarter, reported a total high-speed internet customer net addition was 633,000, their best quarterly result on record. From a business point of view, Charter added 363,000 mobile lines in the third quarter, up from 276 during the year-ago period. As of September 30th, it served a total of 2.1 million mobile lines. Residential internet net adds increased by 492,000, well ahead of consensus expectations of 360,000, and total residential video net adds of 53,000 were positive for the second quarter in a row, far better than expectations of 200,000. The company's third quarter earnings reached $814 million, compared with $387 million of a year-ago period. Earlier this week, Verizon on the wireless phone front unveiled a promotional deal to offer the upcoming Disney Plus streaming service to its mobile users for free for a year under a pact with Walt Disney, say, will boost the service's user figures. Verizon posted third-quarter earnings of $5.3 billion, or $1.25 per share, up from $5.1 billion, or $1.19 a share, in the year-earlier period. Verizon had for some time planned to launch a live TV streaming service for young wireless users who are cord cutters or cord nevers, but then decided to instead offer over-the-top services via the platform. That is why the company earlier this year unveiled a partnership with Google's YouTube TV streaming service, serving as a reseller. Comcast revenue for the third quarter of 2020 decreased 4.8% to $25.5 billion, and for the 9 months ended September 30th, revenue decreased 5.8% to $75.9 billion compared to 2019. The net of all this is that in cable TV subscribers, Charter gained 67,000 new subscribers year-to-date. Verizon lost 232,000 subscribers year-to-date, and Comcast lost 1,138,000 subscribers year-to-date. On the other hand, in terms of the broadband business, Charter added 537,000 new internet users year-to-date. Verizon added 46,100 new internet users year-to-date. And Comcast added 556,000 new internet users year-to-date. So, with the pandemic and the cord-cutting, seems that these cable companies are not really losing money. In fact, I think they want to lose the cable subscriber business and just get into the streaming business with the internet. Raspberry Pi is the third best-selling computer brand in the world. The Raspberry Pi is a credit card-sized computer that plugs into your TV or display and a keyboard and a mouse, and you could use it to learn coding and to build electronic projects. And for many of the things that your desktop PC does, like spreadsheets and word processing, browsing the internet, and playing games, it also plays high-definition video. The Raspberry Pi is being used by adults and children all over the world to learn programming and digital making. This unit was created and sold by Raspberry Pi Foundation, a nonprofit organization. Well, they just come up with a brand new product. It's called the Raspberry Pi 400. It's a complete personal computer. The system is built into a compact keyboard. On the motherboard is a BCM 2711 quad-core Cortex A72 64-bit system on a chip, running 1.5 GHz. The CPU features a quad-core 64-bit processor, 4 GB of RAM, wireless networking, dual display output, and 4K video playback, as well as a 40-pin GPIO header, and that's for running electronic experiments. In benchmarks matching the CPU to the Intel Celeron N2806 with 2 GB of RAM found in Chromebooks, the Raspberry Pi 400 CPU was 3.8 times the speed of the original Atom processor and 2.3 times the speed of the Intel Celeron N2806 found in many of the low-end Chromebooks that are sold. That is impressive. Raspberry Pi is a powerful and easy-to-use computer built into a neat and portable keyboard. The Pi 400 is about 20% faster than the Pi 4. It has largely the same components under the hood, but on a different laid-out board. It's a long, rectangular board that slips into or inside of a keyboard. And its BCM 2711 CPU, by the way, that's from Broadcom, is clocked a touch higher than the BCM 2011 in the Pi 4. It's a Raspberry Pi designed into a keyboard. The Raspberry Pi 400 incorporates a purpose-built board based on Raspberry Pi 4, featuring specially designed thermos to keep the computer cool and silent while it is running. I looked at a video of a disassembly of the Raspberry Pi 400, and to take it apart, there are no screws. Everything pops open. It's pieces of plastic that snaps together. So I wouldn't say it's a heavy-duty unit, but it's unusually designed. The GPIO pins remain accessible in the back of the unit. The keyboard computer itself sells for $70. It is also available in a computer kit with a mouse, power supply, micro HDMI to HDMI cable, and an SD card preloaded with the Raspberry Pi OS, and there's also the official Raspberry Pi Beginner's Guide to help you get the most out of your new computer. All that costs $100. I think I would just buy the whole kit and get the whole thing and not worry about getting all the pieces together. The Raspberry Pi 400 keyboard comes in different languages: UK, US English, Spanish, French, German, and Italian, and there's more to come. The Raspberry Pi OS is the official supported operating system, so you get the smoothest performance from your new computer while you get stuff done. It's a customized Linux distribution for the unit. The Raspberry Pi 400 is the perfect educational tool for students of all ages. Low cost, it's portable, it is ideal for home study, and for teaching computer concepts like programming, physical computing, and networking. And of course, like I said before, you could use it like a regular home consumer computer, doing spreadsheets, word processing, watching video, listening to music, and you can have fun with the unit. In addition to the CPU, there's a dual band 2.4 GHz and 5.0 GHz IEEE 802.11bgnanc wireless LAN. There's Bluetooth 5.0. There's a gigabit Ethernet connector. There's two USB 3.0 ports and one USB 2.0 port. There, of course, is a 40-pin GPIO header. There's two HDMI ports, and it can support two 4K ports. There's the H.265 4K P60 decode, H.264 1080p 60 decode, 1080p 30 encode, and OpenGL ES3.0 graphics. There's a micro SD card slot for the operating system and data storage. And the keyboard is either 78 or 79 keys, depending on the language. And there's a 5-volt DC USB connector. And the operating temperature is 0 centigrade to 50 centigrade ambient. The dimensions, and I don't have it in inches, but I'll give it to you in millimeters, 286 millimeters by 122 millimeters by 23 millimeters. And this unit comes with an obsolescence statement, which is like, I find this most unusual. They said that this Raspberry Pi 400 personal computer will remain in production until at least January 2026. By the way, the Raspberry Pi OS, previously called Raspbian, is the official operating system for all models of the Raspberry Pi. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series. Data piracy is still hard, even work from home.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. Let's utilize my experience to answer a question that came in. And this question basically goes along the lines of this. With so much work that is happening at home, the work from home, the work via remote, all of this, you know, stuff that's part of the new phase that we are currently in, does decentralizing the office make data piracy harder or easier? And the answer I'm going to give you comes from this. Let's put ourselves in the mind of how do we get data away from the company? How do we take proprietary information, all of the different bits and pieces of whatever it is that's out there, take that and put it someplace else? Now, we have this idea in our mind that somehow it's going to be a lot easier. It's going to be just immensely easier because nobody is watching us. Nobody is keeping an eye on everything that we do. We have in our mind that this is going to be just, you know, so much easier because we have our computer now at home. Nobody's sitting over our shoulder. Nobody's watching what we're doing. And now we can stick a flash drive into the system and take off with the data. Nope. I mean, yes, we can. But I'll tell you, honestly, of all of the different places I've worked, if I ever stuck a flash drive, or anybody stuck a flash drive into a system, nobody would bat an eye. These flash drives have become so ubiquitous in our day-to-day activities. Everybody's leaving a copy of their resume with, you know, on a flash drive. I'll tell you, on any given day, I usually have at least three flash drives with me. At least three. There's one in my wallet. Meaning, I don't leave home without it. If I've left home without my wallet, we've got other issues we're dealing with. So I have a flash drive that sits in my wallet on a daily basis. It has copies of my resume. It has copies of the programming for the soundboard at church. It has copies of a number of different bits and pieces of my life all the way throughout. And it's the most important. I'm not even going to say 32 gigs of my life. It's more of the most important 5 gigs of my entire life is sitting on one of those flash drives. And yes, I back it up on a regular basis. If I were to stick it into any of my work computers, nobody would bat an eye. Of course, they know me as a computer nerd, but that's another story altogether. So does it make it easier? No, not really. It's not much different. Yeah, people are going to feel less scared about doing it. But I'll tell you the flip side of it. Most work computers these days, if they're concerned about your accessing certain bits and pieces of the information that's out there, they've locked down your system. I worked for an aerospace subcontractor for about a decade. And one of the things that I did during that decade was lock it down so that nobody could use the floppy drive, the CD writer, the flash drives. They could not move data over to portable drives if they wanted to because they were just completely, totally locked out. And part of that was done simply because we did not want government secrets out in the wild. We would get in massive trouble if that information were ever released. Did we have exceptions? Yes. Did we have situations where, yes, if you wanted data put onto a floppy drive, a flash drive, whatever it was, a CD, could we do it? Yes. You had to go to certain people I was one of them. And you had to say, I need this put onto this flash drive. Great. Actually, we issued flash drives. If you had information you needed on a flash drive, I could simply go, okay, here, give me a moment. I would grab the flash drive. I'd say, where is the data that you want put onto it? It's here. Great. Okay. Let me move it. I'll move that, I'll look it over. Yeah, none of this seems to be, state secrets. Nobody's going to be, interrogating you off in some Russian gulag. So yeah, we'll put that onto the flash drive. I did have some people come to me and say, hey, can I have a flash drive? I kind of chuckled and like, it's not going to work in your computer, right? It's not. What? Yeah, we've got it locked down. So yeah, a lot of the different companies will do that. Another thing that they do is they track all of the information that you're moving back and forth. If you export the entire company list of customers, yeah, somebody's going to notice. They may notice and not even say anything. They may be watching you a lot closer. And the reality is, in this day and age, is your job, forget your job, is your integrity worth it? Ooh, I have a copy of all of our customers, and I'm going to go to another company, and I'm going to say, I want a job because I have all of the customers. You know what companies say these days? Yeah, no thanks. Why? Because if you're willing to violate the sanctity of your current employer, that means you're going to do the same to your next employer and future employers. Yeah, this starts to get really ugly. Yeah, data theft is going to happen, but it's not going to be as dramatic and amazing as you might think. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. A free alternative to Zoom teleconferencing. Many schools are using Zoom, a video calling program, to give live classes to students during the coronavirus pandemic. Several privacy concerns have been raised regarding the Zoom app, however, which can be abused for so-called Zoom bombing. Zoom bombing is a term used to describe an attack where strangers join your Zoom call and disrupt the conversation. This can happen via hacks as well as from something as simple as guessing the Zoom ID of your meeting. The Zoom video calling app is strictly banned in U.S. schools over privacy and security concerns. New York City has already banned its schools from using this app. There is a teleconferencing application that looks like Zoom and it functions like Zoom. The service allows users to host online meetings also for free and has many of the key features and tools you'll find with paid services, including web management, call recording, and calendar integrations. Individuals can make their own conference calls and host up to 100 people for 6 hours completely free. Is this application a clone of Zoom? No. Zoom was created by Eric Yuan. Zoom Video Communications, Inc. is an American communications technology company headquartered in San Jose, California. It provides video telephony and online chat services through a cloud-based peer-to-peer software platform and is used for teleconferencing, telecommuting, distance education, and social relations. There is a company, FreeConferenceCore.com, and it is 10 years older than Zoom. FreeConferenceCore.com is a website founded in 2001 in Long Beach, California. The company is one of the largest providers of conference calls services online. FreeConferenceCalls.com offers a robust conference calling service for no cost. Whenever something is for free, I always ask, what is the business model that they use to pay the bills? The company makes its money by routing non-toll free calls through lesser-used exchanges around the country for a small fee provided by the exchange provider. That's because most of us have national calling plans where the cost of the call is included. But the traffic is valuable for the exchange because they get a fraction of a cent from the carriers for every minute that an incoming call connects through them. The service has been reliable and extremely popular. In fact, Since it started in 2001, the company claims 250 million annual users and more than 800,000 businesses using the service. 9 billion, that's with a capital B, minutes were logged through freeconferencecalls.com last year, making it one of the top five conferencing services in the world. Last month, the company launched a new paid services aimed at those larger businesses, and for those businesses, it won't be free. The new service will offer secure and high-quality, high-definition audio and video conference calls with 99.99% reliability, white-label corporate branding with a personalized audio greeting, hold music and messaging, and PBX integration, and something else that many of us using the free service aren't used to, live 24/7 customer support and training. The company is betting that corporate users will want their own hosted conferencing system that they can completely control, something that they claim that their competitors don't yet provide. And they're also betting that companies will value these services enough to pay something for them. Most companies today are using toll-free conference call systems and paying for those incoming calls. FreeConferenceCall.com wants them to switch to their service, use their existing calling plans to call its numbers, and get a much better, flexible, customized interface, or at a lower cost than what is already being paid. Assuming that your company pays 0.005 cents per minute and uses 500,000 minutes per month, Free Conference Call prices cost about $6,000 less per year than its competitors, according to the company. However, for fellow lovers of FreeConferenceCall.com, the individualized service that you've grown to love is still free, and there are no plans to change that. But the landscape is changing for those mid-sized and larger companies who are looking for a better, more affordable alternative to their conferencing services, even if it does cost a little more than free. So for those who are using Zoom for social reasons or for small nonprofit groups, you do have an alternative to Zoom. For those who bought a Windows 10 PC with the initial introduction of Windows 10, these systems were equipped with 32GB or 64GB of eMMC storage. These were soldered onto the motherboard, making a hardware upgrade virtually impossible. Windows 10 has a smaller footprint than earlier versions of Windows. But if you have a Windows tablet or laptop with a small storage drive, every byte counts. And here are some ways to make Windows take up less room on your hard drive or solid-state drive. According to the specifications and requirements of Windows 10, in order to install the operating system on a computer, users need to have 16 gigabytes of free storage on the drive for the 32-bit version. But if users are going to install the 64-bit version of the operating system, then 20 gigabytes of free hard disk storage is needed. Most of that is made up of system and reserve files, while the 1 gigabyte is taken up by default apps and games that come with Windows 10. This might not sound like a lot, but if you have a cheap 32-gigabyte Windows laptop, or even a 64-gigabyte one, it's a significant portion of your storage space taken up by the operating system. And if you're now unable to upgrade Windows 10 because of the storage that's available, all is not lost. You can reclaim some of that space used by Microsoft Windows 10. You can reduce Windows footprint by uninstalling default Windows 10 apps, disabling the hibernation, and tweaking the virtual memory settings. All these strategies work in previous versions of Windows, except for uninstalling Windows 10 default apps. Such apps as Groove Music, Xbox, Mail and Calendar, Maps, and Xbox can't be uninstalled from here. You have to use the PowerShell commands to get rid of them. When you hibernate your computer, Windows saves your computer's current state, your open documents and programs to your storage drive, so you can resume your work when you turn the computer back on. If you don't use hibernation mode, you can disable it and get rid of the hibrfil.sys file or the hibrfil.sys file, which takes up several gigabytes of storage space, and remove the option to hibernate your system. which saves your computer state to memory instead of your hard drive and keeps your computer on but in a low power state. You could also change the virtual memory size in Windows 10 to pick up space. With virtual memory, if your computer doesn't have enough physical memory to run a program or operation, Windows will temporarily move some data from RAM to a paging file on your hard drive. You can limit how much space this paging file takes up. Alternatively, you can select no paging file or leave the system to manage the file size. But for performance reasons, you should have a paging file. These steps could free up several gigabytes of space on your hard drive by limiting how much space Windows take up on your computer. Windows stores all your user files and folders in C:users, followed by your username. There you see folders such as desktop, downloads, documents, music, and pictures. In Windows 10, these folders also appear in File Explorer under this, PC, and Quick Access. To pick up more available space, move your user folders to another drive. This way you can use the valuable space on the solid-state drive for apps and games that benefit from the speed and performance of a solid-state drive. I use the built-in micro SD card reader in the system as extended storage. For more detailed information on moving user folders, do a search with the following syntax. How to change the location of user folders in Windows 10. Just remember to make the changes in your backup procedures to include the move user folders. These changes will extend the usefulness of that low-cost Windows 10 PC equipped with either 32 gigabytes or 64 gigabytes of eMMC storage. Caveat emptor. There are computer and computer equipment reviews, and there are computer and computer equipment reviews. Black Friday and Cyber Monday are now events of the past. Retailers have already started their full-court press to sell you their products online. There is a high probability that you may be buying computer equipment without ever first seeing the product. You will, however, do your due diligence by reading all the materials and reviews before making the purchase. Since equipment reviews are something all of us, including myself, spend a bit too much time obsessing over, it's worth taking a step back to think about what they do and do not have to offer. It's not a crime to read equipment reviews or to enjoy them. It is not meant to be a declarative statement of how an equipment review should be written. This is just my thoughts on the usefulness of equipment reviews and how I, as a consumer, find them to be most of use. There's a lot of talk of specifications and what's trending, but there are usually only a handful of real-world, unfiltered practical reviews of how the equipment performs on the job. There is a lot of the usual hyperbole about what features you absolutely have to have in your computer to call yourself an IT professional. According to the dictionary, a professional means that you derive the bulk of your living from a profession, not that you use a certain brand of computer. Not that those things can't be important. And those types of things are of interest when viewing equipment reviews and deciding on whether a piece of equipment is right for you. Specs do matter, maybe just not as much as we think they do. And when we're making a decision of computer systems, the decision is personal. I find some things far more useful than others. Basic spec information can be helpful, although I find this to be less useful than it might seem. If a particular spec really is important to you, then when you go to purchase a computer, every website is going to have a tab for specifications. Those things may or may not be deal breakers for you or me, but what I'm far more likely want to know is how that applies to my specific computing needs. The only thing that matters when it comes to equipment, I'm less concerned with the numbers and more concerned with usability. How does a product perform? I don't need to hear complaints about what features are missing. If you're in the market for a computer, what matters is what features you must have for your work. However, I do see value in comparing computer models. If someone was buying into a computer system in a vacuum and was trying to decide which way to go, this information would be helpful. But of course, consumers are really shopping in a vacuum which makes the job of making computer recommendations all the more challenging. What also needs to be taken into account is who is a target customer for a certain product. Obviously, it is impossible for a computer reviewer to share the exact perspective of everyone reading or viewing the review. And it's silly to expect a reviewer to see the world or a piece of equipment in exactly the same way I would. But what I personally appreciate most in a review is a deep dive into how the tool serves the purpose and the audience for which it is intended. It's important when sharing our opinions, either in review form or in comment sections, that we acknowledge that not everyone is approaching the endpoint coming from the same direction. And until the day when there is a computer company that releases that holy grail with that one computer that fits the needs for everyone, it's more useful to consider each equipment introduction based on its own specific use case. We can't allow ourselves to review computers based on spec sheets, nor we base our reviews on other people's reviews. At that point, it's not really a review, but rather an exercise in mob mentality. It's unlikely the reviews will be unanimous with computers. So the one red flag that does get raised for me is when I see one aspect of a computer release, usually a fairly insignificant feature to actual workflow, get blown out of proportion and suddenly becomes a lead item in all reviews going forward. I don't want to know whether or not someone declares it the best computer ever made, or if someone personally deems it professional or not. I want to know for the market and the end users for which it is intended, this is the tool that helps me to do my job. What job is this piece of equipment best suited to serve? Is there a better alternative, either on the market or maybe just sticking with the older equipment, than investing in this product to serve its intended purpose? The bottom line is whether or not the purchase improves my productivity. I don't mean to suggest that computer reviews aren't both fun and worthwhile. I watch and read them myself and will continue to do so. But while doing so, I also remind myself that computers are purpose-built for the specific jobs that they are meant to perform. So we need to take into account the circumstances it will be faced with in order to give a complete review. There is a limit to trusting someone else's opinion. The only real way to know if a computer is right for you or not is to actually use it yourself. As much as I like to hear in-depth descriptions of others' personal experiences with a computer, there is no substitute for holding it in my own hand and putting it into the field. Presenting Marty Winston on Home Automation, Dazed and Glazed for the Holidays.
Everybody always knew that seeing things perfectly meant having 20/20 vision. At least until we got into 2020, everything's different, and you can be very sure indeed, it's one of this year's few certainties, that holiday shopping this year will be dramatically different from what it was in years past. And don't kid yourself. Most of the abnormalities of 2020 will still be part of the immediate normal through a lot of 2021. There will be a lot of working and learning from home, a lot of people going to video conference meetings wearing dress shirts and pajama bottoms, far fewer hours in cars, reduced opportunities for working out, and for many of your neighbors, friends, and family, frighteningly less to spend even on necessities. You can call this report Dazed and Glazed for the Holidays. But before you get crazed, prepare to be amazed at some clever ways to get through it. Start with this year's update to common sense. Guys, if all your presents turned out to be neckties, how long do you think it will be before you have an opportunity to wear any one of them? Apply the same question to suits and sport coats, or ladies, to skirts or pantsuits for work, or dresses or gowns or heels. Well, for evenings out that you're not going to be able to go out to, how long before you would have a chance to wear them? And across the board, trying on clothes to find the right size and see how they look on you is difficult to impossible in the stores that are still open. So many aren't opening again. That doesn't mean clothes aren't viable as gifts. Jeans are always welcome, and sweaters and scarves and gloves and pullovers. Also, pajamas, got to replace them sooner or later, and maybe underwear. Note that the kids don't regard any of these things as what they expect to be inside the gift wrap. Clothes are a good starting point because those brick-and-mortar stores that cater to younger tweens and up shoppers still have lines at the door, while many of the work-style clothing stores might as well have cobwebs on their doors. A lot of electronics in the house got a lot more hours of usage this year. Did your tablet or notebook or smartphone take a beating? Careful. If it's just a matter of scratches, keep using it because there's no sense subjecting something new to the same kind of beating for the next 6 or 8 or 10 months. If it's cracked or broken or really getting in the way of working, a new one might make sense, but be smart. If it's yours and you use it for work, then work might be willing to underwrite some chunk of the cost of replacing it. And it doesn't hurt to ask. If it's something the kids use, don't show your cards. Make them think that you just can't afford a new one. And if they're careful with the one they have, then they might be able to make do. Then, if they do start showing more care and less carelessness or abuse, well, you can always surprise them with a new one. How bad is the TV set? Put the idea of a huge screen for your Super Bowl party out of your mind. If you can see what's being shown, keep it. There are some other ways to make it better. If your internet speeds are decent, you can watch the streaming channels. If not, Roku or TiVo streaming adapters might be worth considering. If you can already show streams, then there are many premium services that might be interesting as gifts. Peacock and CBS All Access and Amazon Prime Video and Netflix and Hulu and many others. Some of them have gift cards you can gift wrap. Others may be harder to look like pile builders under the tree. Presents should be fun. Don't get Dad a new snow shovel or Mom a new broom. He'd probably prefer a new cordless power tool or LED flashlight. She might like, oh, I don't know, a neck massager or a favorite adult beverage. Together, they might enjoy a gift card to a local restaurant that managed to reopen and looks like it can keep going. With all of the candies and cookies of the holidays, you might think that more of those would be welcome, and they might for a night or two, but a lot of people are still trying to lose the pandemic 15, and some of them gained even more. Skip food this year. Some of the shopping puzzle involves knowing where to shop. Many malls have closed, and even in the ones that are still open, there aren't as many stores as there used to be. The same is true for strip shopping centers and even for outlet malls. Besides, those places all increase your risk of infection. Shopping online simply makes more sense this year. Amazon has a lot of good stuff, but there are many other places you can investigate, like all the dot-coms for Home Depot, Lowe's, QVC, and lots more. But do, please, be careful. Some of the sites sound like they're associated with legitimate store names, but they're close variations on stores that went out of business and some of the products. Here's an important tip. Unless your smartphone is the only device you have that lets you shop online, don't use your smartphone. Use a tablet or, much better, a full-fledged PC with a browser. The bigger web pages in a browser let you see more content on each product page. We almost bought a cabinet that turned out to be poorly built and not much larger than a storage box. The reviews gave that away, but those reviews were not obvious when going to the product page on a smartphone. Let's cross a few ideas off your list, and this list isn't necessarily always true for everybody, but it's a fair example of how to narrow your gift-giving decisions. Don't give luggage. Nobody you know is doing any traveling. Don't give toilet paper. It's inappropriate, and anyway, the people who would be eager to get it probably still have some left from hoarding it back in February. Calendars are iffy. They're just not useful if you never know what day-to-day is. Be careful with prepaid gift cards. If they're for a store, that store may not be in business anymore. Cologne is always iffy. The unspoken message with cologne is that without this, you don't smell nice. If you want to give a pet, do not give a chihuahua. Nobody wants to be stuck staying safe at home with an annoying little noise machine. Four toddlers are placid by comparison. No chihuahuas. And even if the recipient seems serious about dropping the Pandemic 15, don't give a Peloton. There won't be any room left for it next to their other Peloton. No, this year your gifting will have to get more creative. Large art prints are a nice way to jazz up the wall behind them when the camera's on in an e-meeting. A simple cushion can make any of their random work-at-home chairs more comfortable. If you want to buy somebody a mask, make it funny. For example, it might say, "I'm not wearing this because I care about your health. I'm wearing it because I'm ugly." Yeah, everything's different this year. Spend some time looking at the specials on Amazon. No, you don't have to buy any of them, but they might spark some ideas about things that you'd like to have or things that are naturals for people you know. Amazon, alas, is as close as you're likely to get to window shopping for the 2020 holidays. Next time, our twin focus is on veterans and on technology. There's more common ground than most people know. That report is A Geek Salute to Service. You have your orders. Be here.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. The Westchester PC User Group meets Thursday, November the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Remote attendance is via Zoom. Their website is wpcug.org. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, November the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Jitsi Meet. Their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, November the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets November the 13th. That's Friday the 13th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is limac.org. The Princeton PC Users Group meets Tuesday, November the 24th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is ppcug-nj.apcug.org. And the Brookdale Computer Users Group, well, they meet on a Thursday, and they normally meet on the fourth Thursday of each month, but it happens to be Thanksgiving Day. So go to their website to get more information as when the new date will be for the meeting. Their website is bcug.com. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet. And if you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.